This morning, my privilege is to bring to you, in the book of Philippians, chapter 4, a couple of verses that I want to be able to highlight. So if you have your Bible, I would love you to find it around the room. Philippians, small little book. We've been studying it all summer. We're going to do it a couple more weeks. And we're going to have a nice, Mike's going to walk us through a nice crescendo of this beautiful, wonderful book as we have walked our way through it virtually, with a little bit of an exception, but virtually all summer long. We're in chapter 4 of Philippians, and it's verses 8 and 9. I want to read to you out of the New Living Translation what these verses say. Now, remembering, this is in English, obviously, okay? This is an English-speaking service, but in English, even the Bible is written. We're reading it out of English, and there are words there to translate some things that we're going to kind of deal with as we go along, but I want you to capture what Paul says in Philippians chapter 4, verses 8 and 9. And now, dear brothers and sisters, one final thing, a little quick commentary. Remember, he's writing a letter. He's writing a letter to the church at Philippi. And as he's writing this letter, he's been telling them about, you know, the beauty and the enormity of Christ, and then he's been talking about worry, and he's been talking about prayer. And last week we had this, what I thought was a beautiful experience of a worship service, and we learned to pray for each other, something that we need to learn, always be challenged to do more and more. And I think appropriately so, Mike, we ought to, I don't know how you do that, we're just taking the time to just pray for each other. But all of those things that the Apostle Paul was writing to this church at Philippi about, he now sort of comes near the end. We're not quite to the end of the letter yet, but he says, now I have one final thing for you. My dear brothers and sisters, one final thing. Fix your thoughts on what is true. Fix your thought life on what is true and honorable and right and pure and lovely and admirable. Think about things that are excellent and worthy of praise. That's a long list. He literally, again, we're using these words in English, the original Greek words. Obviously, we're now trying to do our best to convey what he's trying to say, but he says again, fix your thoughts. My final thought to all of you, fix your brain on these things. Put your thought pattern on these things. Those things that are true and honorable and right and pure and lovely and admirable. Think about the things that are excellent and worthy of praise. Praiseworthy. Keep putting into practice all that you've learned and received from me. Everything you heard from me and saw me doing. And then the God of peace will be with you. We're talking about joy all summer. And the joy that comes out of the book of Philippians, this beautiful, short, but amazingly profitable letter. And it's amazing to me that he comes, I got this one last thing. You want peace? You want that real, the peace and the joy of life? Then you need to fix your thoughts on these things. So, question for all of you is, if thoughts are such a big deal, what were you thinking about when you came into church service this morning? You know one thing about thoughts? I'll tell you one thing about thoughts. They're yours, and nobody else knows what they are, right? Thank you, God, sometimes, right? I mean, we can hide our thoughts, right? We know what we're thinking. And I don't know if you're like me, but sometimes these bizarre thoughts come along. And some of them are stupid, some of them are silly, some of them are crazy, some of them are completely out of left field. Some of them are wonderful and helpful, some of them are actually quite destructive. But the truth is, I can sit there and talk to you. I'm actually pretty good about it. I'm embarrassed to tell you, but I'm pretty good about this. I can talk to you and carry on a conversation and be thinking about something totally different. So if you ever hear me sit there and say, uh-huh, oh yeah, that's awesome. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's great. Oh man, that's awesome. Just come back to me and challenge me and say, what did I just tell you? Now, I joke with that a little bit. I've done that, embarrassingly enough. But I'm not in bad company because you've done the exact same thing. We've all done it. You sit in a meeting, you sit in front of somebody, you sit in front of your kids sometimes. Your kids are telling you the most important things in the world, and your brain is completely somewhere else, right? And you're sitting in school, the teacher's teaching all this stuff, and they say, what's the answer to this question? And you're going, I have no idea what you're talking about because my brain is somewhere else. We've all done that. We all still struggle with doing it. Our thoughts are our own. And nobody, it is one of those hidden things that I can't peek inside your brain. You cannot peek inside of my brain and follow my thoughts on these kinds of things. So really the question is, again, just my simple question is, what were you thinking of when you came to church? You don't have to answer it, but kind of just think about that. Were you mad at somebody? Were you happy with somebody? Were you thinking about a bill that had to be paid? Were you thinking about life? Were you thinking about a struggle? Were you thinking about food? Were you thinking about, what were you thinking about? You know? And so in that same way, I would ask the next question is, what did you spend your week thinking about? What do you think about? What dominates your thought patterns through the course of a week? And then in that same vein, how much of your life is lived based thinking on something that you know is not really true? We'll come back to that. In the book of Philippians chapter 2, I often will read an English translation. And an English translation, of course, means, a real translation means it's trying to really come as accurate as possible, describing what was originally written in these, with these Greek, in this case, a Greek language. And we struggle with putting in different languages. We have people in this room around, from around the world, and you know it happens in every language. We have a Bible written, and the Word of God written in all these different languages. We struggle with what these words are to describe what he was trying to say to that church 2,000 years ago. Well, we also have what we call paraphrases, and a paraphrase really just sort of doesn't worry about necessarily saying the word translation, but tries to convey the idea or the context or the content of what was being said. And one of the modern paraphrases is, we call it the message, and I personally kind of like it because it's kind of fun to just sort of get a perspective on what that same verse says. So here's what it says in the message in Philippians 4, 8, 9. Summing it all up, friends, I'd say you'll do best by filling your mind and meditating on things that are true, noble, reputable, authentic, compelling, gracious. Now think about that. You do your best by filling your minds and meditating. Fill your minds and meditate on these things. And it lists them again. True, noble, reputable, authentic, compelling, gracious. The best, not the worst. The beautiful, not the ugly. Things to praise and not to curse. Put into practice what you learned from me and what you heard and saw and realized. Do that, and God who makes everything work together, that God who makes everything work together, will work you into His most excellent harmonies. It's a really pretty cool way to phrase that. And it all begins with the thinking. The thinking. The thought patterns of life. That is where I want to focus our attention on for a bit. I'm going to tell you a story. And the story is not unlike of the sort of genre, so to speak, of what Jesus taught. You remember when Jesus in the New Testament, in those four Gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, when He would teach to people, He very often used stories and illustrations out of life, stories and illustrations out of agriculture, stories and illustrations out of the physical universe and even science to a high degree, and those kind of things to point to us a great and deep spiritual truth. So in a sense, that's what I thought I would do with you this morning by telling you, as we think about what Paul says, I want you to, here's my final thought, put your thoughts, here's my final word to you, put your thoughts, fix your thoughts on these things. I want to tell you the story of the river. I love rivers. Now, rivers, I grew up in a town that actually had the convergence of two rivers in my town, and they were very well known for that part of the world, and they're very famous in that sense, and they're beautiful. One of them runs out of a lake and kind of comes in. It's a fairly long river. The other one's actually a pretty short river. Comes right out of the hillside of our local town, and it's technically the shortest river in the world, is what they've always told us. And it's 4 or 5 miles long, but it's just beautiful because it kind of comes in. So our town is surrounded by these two rivers that eventually become one river. But rivers are quite lovely, and there's nothing in life, I think, more enjoyable than on a beautiful day to go down by the river and watch the pleasant stream kind of go by, right? I mean, it's just lovely. I grew up kind of swimming in a lot of river, in the river there, and I grew up floating down the river in the summertime, and, you know, life sort of happened along the river, still does to this day in my hometown, and it's just a lovely, you know, physical thing to look at. It's peaceful. I see people grab a book and read a book down there. I see people have picnics down by the river. So we get this concept of the beauty of a river. A river itself, without trying to get into all the science of it or the geology of it, I do kind of want to walk through the dynamics of that river, of the amazing story of what a river is. Most of us, when we picture a river, we picture this sort of a tranquil, beautiful spot. Psalm 1 even has a reference, walk along the river of life and you know, along the stream of life. And so this beautiful image that kind of is conjured up in our mind of that river that sort of flows. But what happens when a tranquil river, it kind of flows along at that certain point, but what happens is eventually even a small river begins to slowly cut through the landscape. And at first, it starts by literally just sort of carving its way out between a couple of rocks, right? It sort of takes its path along that, and it erodes a new kind of a path. Patty and I took a hike here a couple weeks ago up at Staircase, up at Olympic National Park. Beautiful, beautiful setting, and walked up the North Skokomish River, and it's so lovely. At first, it's this beautiful, tranquil part, and then eventually it sort of carves its way down through rocks, and in fact, some of the little boulders that were there, I got a chance to jump off into them, into the beautiful river below, and it has this warm and fuzzy and beautiful feel to it all. The amazing thing about a river is, it may geologically start as that small thing, but at some point in time, it carves a bigger hole. And what it does, it becomes a little bit like what we know of in this photo as the Columbia River. The mighty Columbia. The one that Lewis and Clark came down to explore as the European Eastern American settlers, as they explored the western part of the continental U.S., or the continental North America, and they follow their way down this river. That river, geologically speaking, was founded from long, 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 long ago. This started as first a stream that's exactly what we showed in the earlier photographs, a tranquil stream that eventually cut into rocks, that eventually carved its way down, and then eventually a lot of tributaries came through it, and so became so powerful that after a long period of time, it even cut through the Cascade Mountains, a very famous place that we now call the Gorge, that virtually all of us have driven down, some of us many times. And many of us have stood on that very same spot, overlooking the carved out section of that world that's just south of us, about 150 miles. That's the power of that amazing river. Now, we can also We've discovered that it takes flat ground. Rivers will take a flat piece of ground and carve a brand new canyon into those, right? And it brings about a barrier that is more difficult than anything that we had known before. It's that same idea that if you are walking across a new land that you don't have a map for, like many of the people that traveled all over the world and they came to a river, that river was carving out a really large canyon. It was no longer a tranquil little river. It was now a canyon, and we had to figure out how to cross over that barrier. You obviously know the facts there, so we have to create a boat, or we have to create a bridge, or somehow we want to try to find an access to go across. That was all there because of the story of that amazing river that started just as a small creek or a tranquil little stream that came through. And to the point where it was cutting holes into the earth in an amazing sort of way. We have a picture of the Grand Canyon that gouged all that. And we have this picture here of another canyon that was just literally forged out of what at one time, geologically speaking, was nice, navigable, flat land. And that river carves its way on through. We have scenes like this up at Mount Rainier National Park. It over on the other side around by Ohanapakash in that area, and those beautiful, there's these canyons that just go down, 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 down. Why were they formed there? Because of the power of the carving of that river. Now follow me. Then we have, when these holes are cut into the sides of these landscapes, the landscape is changed forever. The Amazon River. The Amazon River is truly takes up well over half of the continent of South America. That river dictates what happens in South America. Geologically speaking, if you go back in time, it was at some point came across as this little simple stream that eventually flowed in tributaries that came across, and pretty soon it dominates the landscape of that entire continent, all because of this incredible river. It has changed the face of the land. It has changed and dictated the life and well-being of the people on that land, all because of the flowing of that river. The Nile River, one of my favorite rivers, and I think it's just so much history behind it. I had the privilege one time of standing in on the banks of the Nile River, and I watched this river that I've heard about all my life and studied throughout all of history in my life, and it starts in a place that's not terribly far from where our team came from in Uganda the other day, but it comes out of those mountains of Africa and out of those beautiful places of Africa, and eventually cut through this enormous desert in North Africa, and it is shaped not just the landscape, but it's shaped civilizations. One of the greatest civilizations of all of the world was the Egyptian Empire of the past. Not possible without the shaping of that river, Nile. You see, and you kind of know this, but I want to tell you that and make sure you grasp the power of the river. Rivers can do that. And they do dictate and shape landscapes and civilizations, but they also can sometimes go out of control. When they go out of control, they run at high speeds down those same channels, and all of a sudden the power, what was this tranquil stream, all of a sudden becomes something powerful and moves rocks and boulders and eventually mountains and cuts out new gorges along the way. And sometimes when the river gets completely out of control, life completely as we know it gets chaotic. It extends its banks far beyond what we know of as the normal in that. Now I have, through my teaching over the years, I've told many times my story of the flood that I was in one time in 1971. And in a 12-hour time period, it rained more than 20 inches. And those tranquil rivers that I was in and around in my hometown rose 45 feet overnight. My father, who was a pastor, did over 20 funerals for people in the coming weeks as a result of a river that was a beautiful place that we used to love to play on that now became devastating, carved out new channels, made new paths, all because of the power of the river. When it overflows, it breaks and brings chaos. Homes are then destroyed. And all of a sudden, these houses that thought they were going to be on dry land, they thought they were going to have peace, all of a sudden they find nothing but turmoil, nothing but chaos, because the river extended its borders and lives are at that point changed forever. All because of the power and the story of the river. Rivers change the world, don't they? Rivers shape the physical imprint of this earth. You can be in space and watch and look and see how the physical landscape of this earth has been changed because of the mighty power of the river that flows. And just everything in our humanity has been shaped by, and life on earth has been shaped by the power of the river. Rivers shape the character of the earth, don't they? They do. Your life has been shaped by a river. So there's my long illustration, and here's my point. After walking you through something you already knew, but I wanted to take the step-by-step in all of that, because I want you to grasp this point. If rivers shape the earth in such a powerful way, what does the thought life, what does my thought life shape and do to my soul? I believe the Apostle Paul, as he writes this, would say, and allude to this very simple point, but I think very blunt point, our thoughts carve out the index that shape the character of our soul. The things that you think about, the thought patterns that become the habits of your life, the styles of thinking that goes on in your brain and how you process that out and what you think about carve an imprint and an index that shape and do shape the character of your soul. The soul is who you really are, can be seen from a distance, just like in space and a river. They can be seen in your heart and your life. Isn't that something? I believe that our thoughts literally draw the lines. I think they literally, it's an illustration for sure, because a thought, again, is unlike a river. I can't see what your thoughts are. Someone else cannot know what your thoughts are. But let me tell you what the thoughts do. They work exactly like rivers. They draw lines. They carve out sort of habitual canyons in your life. They shape the personality that you have. They form obstacles and barriers that often need to be bridged in your life. Positively or negatively, thoughts do. They outline the character of your life. They form the identity of what is yours and what is ours. They manipulate your thought patterns, will manipulate the direction and the path of your life. Just your thoughts. Those quiet thoughts, those personal private thoughts that are yours. That's what they do. And in the end, they can either be a strength that you can build your life on, or they can be a weakness that can absolutely crush you. That's why I think the Apostle Paul in Philippians 4 says this. He says, one final thing. One final really important thing. This is important. One final thought. One final thing for you. Fix your thoughts on these things. Sometimes we take the Bible and we treat it like it's, you know, Paul would say, yeah, I got a little advice for you. I got a nice little tidbit of a pleasant thing to give you. Here's a decent idea. He doesn't say that. He said, boy, if you're going to shape your life, And he doesn't use the illustration of the river. I'm the one that's trying to point that out, but I can guarantee you when you look at all of the Scripture and you look at all of humanity and all of the truths of what we know about human beings, when Paul says, fix your thoughts on these things, he says, this is critical. In fact, there's a term that I love that often is used in church. We don't really use it a lot in sort of common English language. I mean, not really, but the word dwell on these things. Dwell. I like that word dwell. And because dwell means you settle in. It means you park yourself there. It means you're literally moving in there. You're homesteading there. It's finding your thing. When he says fix your thoughts on these things, he's not just saying let this be a passive thought. He's saying find yourself here. Your lives are going to be shaped by your thoughts. The imprint of your character is going to be shaped by the thought patterns that go on in your life. Find yourself here. Your thoughts are going to carve out the index that shape the character of your soul. Fix your thoughts on these things. And here they are. Let's walk through them. All of those. Fix your thoughts on these things that are, number one, true. Fix your thoughts on whatever is true. You know, in other words, the original word is things like, you know, in other words, to try to describe it, they're not concealed. You know, again, thoughts are private and nobody else knows them. But what he's really saying is that fix your thoughts on the, not the hidden things, but the truthful things, the revealed things, the things that we know to be true. Don't live a lie. Don't live under false pretense. Don't live under some things that you all of a sudden buy into that you know are not going to be true. But temporarily you buy into because it's more convenient. Fix your thoughts on those things that are true. And the list just goes on. Whatever is honorable. Whatever is honorable, those things that are noble, those things that are honest, those things that are admirable, those things that are revered, those things that are esteemed, those the honorable, pure kinds of things that are out there. And the word pure is used in English in a different way here, but this is a bit of a different word. It's just that noble concept. Boy, how many things do we live for and think about that are trashy? I take the trash out every Thursday morning in my house. I hope so, okay? Because if I don't, then it has to wait a whole nother week. And I've often told people that once in a while I like to go to the dump. You know, the dump? You like to go out there and back up I have a pickup, so I get to back up my pickup and throw out all the trash out. You know why I like to do that? Because it just feels so good at getting rid of a bunch of garbage. You've been sitting and looking at a bunch of stuff for so long, and then finally you're just sort of, I don't need this anymore. I've been living like I need this stuff, and now I don't need it. Now, this doesn't speak to landfills and all that recycle, whatever. But I love to just get rid of stuff. I do recycle, okay? I do. But you get my point, is that we hang on to stuff that are not honorable. We hang on to stuff that are not truths, and I get tired of sometimes living with the garbage that gets collected in my life. I want to keep the things that are admirable and true. And Paul says, whatever is true, whatever is admirable, esteemed, things that are not corrupted. Jesus says, why would you live your life for the things that you know moth and rust will destroy? Jesus said those things. Jesus said, why would you spend your time building up all this stuff that you know isn't going to have any real long-term value? You know, I use this illustration in the first service, is that my wife has kind of gotten me into, I'll admit it, she's gotten me into garage selling. Okay? And once in a while, to go out on dates, it's a hot date too, baby. We go out garage selling. And we put our $5 in coins in our pocket, and we go out and buy as much crap as we possibly can buy. And we do pretty good at it. We bought this thing the other day that nobody wanted. And nobody could figure out what to do with it. And believe it or not, we We got it. We found it's going to, I mean, I'm not even going to get into it, but this little counter thing, and it's like, this is, we looked at it last night and went, this is awesome. You know, it's awesome. It's going to be awesome, all right? We're not there yet, but now, I use that as a silly illustration to point out that you know, we, on the flip side of that, it is also amazing to me when you do a garage sale, how much junk is in the back of your pickup. And then you think to yourself, Patty says, always, well, I said, what are we going to do with all this stuff? Well, we'll have a garage sale. Didn't make any sense to me at all. But you know, I go along with it and I actually have a little fun with it occasionally. But the point is, isn't it funny how much stuff, not, I mean, we all do this, but how much stuff we collect thinking they're of such great value, when in reality, Paul says, fix your things upon the things that are not corruptible. They're honorable. They're revered. You're not going to find them at garage sales. You're going to find them in the Word. You're going to find them in the truth of living for Him. And he goes on, whatever is right, in other words, those things that are just, those things that are righteous, those things that are holy, innocent. The opposite of that would be those wrong things, those unholy things, those things that are completely out of sync. It, you know, it's almost a bit of a right or wrong issue. We know what God has called us to do it right. And yet, how much of my own mind is stuck on the things that I know are not right? Which leads us to the next thing. Whatever those things are pure, those things that are innocent, those are modest, they're properly cleaned and pure, they're, the opposite of that would be ugly and unpleasant and terrible and awful. And I'll read the next one. Is whatever things are lovely, those things that are beautiful. It's like looking at a beautiful garden in the springtime. And this year was just such a beautiful spring year around here. And I just loved it when the roadies came out and the wisteria came out and everything was, you know, went to some places and it looked like a Thomas Kincaid photo in some people's yards and some people's, you know, just gorgeous. You drive along the yard places. I loved looking at that. And in that same illustration, Paul says, put your thoughts on the things that are lovely, not the things that are ugly, not the things that are impure, not the things that are destructive, not the things that are unworthy, not the things that are unacceptable. Instead, those things that are splendid. It's like, if you could let me just share this thought, it's like, and I'm really serious when I say this, is it's like even the sexual experience in a lovely home that is beautiful and awesome and full of gorgeous things that God created, and we pervert it with pornography and crap. Things that pervert, things that are ugly. And, you know, every guy in this room, and probably most of the women, have struggled from time to time, including myself, with pornographic issues. Why? We know we're sexual creatures. We know what we're made of. And of course now in the world it's very acceptable, humanly speaking. I hear it talked about on the radio like it's supposed to be. But let me tell you what it does. It perverts the soul from top to bottom. Takes what was intended to be beautiful and great and part of God's intimate creation and turns it into junk. That's the extreme opposite form of that. And I would warn all of us, men and women, young and old, it is certainly a crime for the young. It's an awful experience for the young. And honestly, it only gets worse. It doesn't get better. And I'm not just picking on pornography. However, that's a pretty good illustration of many aspects of the opposite of lovely, the opposite of pure, the opposite of right, the opposite of honorable. There are many other things. Paul says, oh, the river, the thought that goes through your mind shapes the character of your soul. So in this final thought, I'm urging you to think and dwell your thoughts on these things, those things that are true and honorable and right and pure and lovely. And the next one, admirable. Admirable. Oh, respectable, moral excellence, something we can give a good report about, something that is well spoken, something that we're just so proud of. Think on these things. Put them at the top of the shelf. And whatever is excellent, those things that have great valor to them, they stand at the top. They're the kinds of things that the world later in life recognizes that is such great value. Whatever is excellent and whatever is praiseworthy. Now that's a pretty good list. Something worthy of our praise, worthy of our attention, worthy of our honor. That list, we could park on that for a very long time, but that list finds itself in a very short little passage in Philippians 4, verse 8. And much like other places in the Bible that have listed like the fruits of the Spirit and other kinds of things, just word, 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 and all these example, that's what this one is like. But in the end of that, what he says, if you will think on these things, dwell on these things, it will reshape the character of your life. Do we really understand how much our thoughts shape who we are? I'm going to give you little illustrations. I'm going to leave you with a couple simple points. There was a woman named who, back in 1967, was going swimming, and she jumped off into Chesapeake Bay and thought it was deeper than it was, and instead hit the bottom, and she cracked a vertebrae in her neck. And from that point forward, for the rest of her life, and she's still alive, she was paralyzed, quadriplegic, had no feeling below the neck. First part of her life, for the period of time afterward, was full of, like a lot of us would have normally probably felt, an incredible sense of depression, incredible sense of, you know, unworthiness. Incredible. Her thoughts were filled with nothing but ugly. And she, by her own admission, she said, I am worthless, I'm useless, make it over with, it's no good anymore. She learned to paint at some point, came into a real relationship with God, and began to paint, physically paint, using her teeth in her mouth. And she began to not only do that, she began to write. Of course, she physically couldn't write, but she would dictate to others. And then she was asked to speak at some things. And what she found out later on was, the value of her life was not upon the use of her limbs, but upon her willingness to accept the usefulness of God in her own life. And it has completely reshaped her life to this day, and she has touched the lives of millions. Her name is Johnny Erickson, Tata. And everything is different. She even fought breast cancer for a period of time, but everything is different for her today because, not because of the use of her arms, but because she put her mind and fixed her thoughts on these truths. There's another lady that I actually met one time, briefly, but I met her and I heard her speak it when I was in seminary. And a little short Dutch lady from Holland. She's about 4 foot whatever. And little bitty gal. And she spoke to all these young seminary students. She was an elderly woman at that time, and she brought out a gigantic Bible that was bigger than she was, and she put it on top of a pulpit that was taller than she was, and she set it up in front of it, and she let all these young seminary students just have it. She was about 80-something years old at the time. She just preached and preached and told us all what we needed to do with our lives. Her name is Corrie ten Boom. She's dead now, but she was one of the heroes of the faith that in Nazi Germany, her parents, she was a Christian from Holland, and her parents were protecting Jewish people who were being obviously confiscated and taken away into concentration camps, and her family hid them. Her and all of her family went to Auschwitz, and they all perished except for Corrie ten Boom. It's a very familiar story for many of you, but in the middle of all that, she was sitting, her story of being in Auschwitz in this horrible concentration camp was, you know, what use am I of God? I have nothing to give. I had all this talent, all these things I was going to do with my future. And then she finally decided, because her godly sister, who ended up dying, her godly sister trained her, it's not where you are, but it's what you think about. It's not the circumstances of your life, but it's the thought processes that channel and carve out the character of your soul that makes you used by God. And Corrie ten Boom, for the rest of her days, has lived to be an old woman. She was used by God, the Almighty God. We have a couple sitting up here at the front this morning that are from Bangladesh. They're Indian, but they are missionaries in Bangladesh. This is Andrew and Rosalind's parents, Vijay and Apabala. It's the reason I'm wearing this. They gave this to me. It's from Bangladesh, and I'm very proud to wear my Bangladesh shirt, and it actually is quite comfortable. And it hides the stomach, which is nice. But it's a little bonus. But in the middle of all that, I've heard their testimony over and over again. He shared it with our missions team the other day. He shared it with some other people. He and I have spent a lot of time together. In Vijay and Appa, at one point, he was a scientist, was well-esteemed, he has a PhD in reproductive science, and he was working at the major institution of all of India. Appa is a Shakespearean English professor, for crying out loud. In India, all right? Her English is better than everybody in this room. And you know what they did? They accepted the call of God to serve in the poorest country in the world, Bangladesh. Why? Why? Just to brag on them. It's the truth. Because they say we want to fix our things in the thing, fix our lives and our minds and our thoughts on the things that are admirable, things that are true, things that are useful. It's not my degree that gets used. It's not my degree that carves out who I am. It's whether or not I'm this. We had a team just came back from Uganda, and I asked some of them on the worship team, and I asked them earlier, I said, tell me, what spoke to you the most? And you know what they said? They said, We watched a group of people who had virtually nothing. It just puts you to shame. She said, we came over thinking we're going to be this poor people. And these guys gave and gave and gave and gave and gave. They just thrilled to give, and they really didn't have anything, but they gave everything they had. We give out of excess, they gave what they had because they loved God. Why can they do that? Why can they do that with such joy? Because these people have learned how to fix their minds on these thoughts of God, not upon the crap that we invest our lives on. I've used crap 3 times in this sermon. Mark it down. It's a good word. I would have never used it 35 years ago. Not on your life. I'd have gotten kicked out of church. But I can use it today. All right? How do we do this? Very simple, but very complicated. I think number one, you have to learn how to reconstruct the habits of our own life. It's like building dams. It's like building bridges. It's like your thoughts really are these rivers that have carved out the character of your soul, and it's time for you to start to reshape that. And that's exactly what the Apostle Paul, when he says, now fix your mind on these things, true and honorable and admirable, you know, on and on and on it goes. Fix your mind on these things. Recognize that habits, actually, as tough as they are, can be adjusted. Even the habits of thoughts that are so terribly destructive, you know, that dam up certain kinds of things and we have to reroute around them. Place new habits in your mind. Number two, I think we are called, as Paul would say, by the way, guys, he says, keep putting into practice all the things that you learn and receive from me. I think that's not a slight statement. You know what I think you can do? Not only do we have to reconstruct our brain and our mind of how we think, but I think we also have to put some mentors in our life, some people in our life that we can look to and say, you know, help me through this. Now, guys, a mentor is a human being, and we're flawed, and even your mentor, as much as you love them, is going to be a flawed human being. But I will tell you this, that Paul says, you know, follow me on this pattern. You can do this better. Hang in there. You need other people. And number three, you got to look to Jesus. Jesus Christ is the only way to ultimately be our greatest example of all. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to ask our worship team if they would. Come on up. And I want us to sing songs of worship, songs of restructuring, songs of reconfiguring. Our mind, our heart, our lives. And contemplate on these words that Paul said. Fix your mind on these things.